One of those crazy fucking vigilante groups, the coyote says. Out playing nighttime Power Rangers, in which case, watch your fronts. Because those hijos de puta would like nothing better than to mount a stuffed migrant head over their mantle at home. Luca grimaces, even though it strikes him as slightly funny. The notion of his head stuffed and mounted on a shiny slab of wood in a Yankee cabin somewhere. None of it's funny to Lydia. She hadn't been naive enough to think they were in the clear yet, but she did think the nature of the most pressing threat would have changed by now. She thought that here in El Norte, she'd have to worry more about Border Patrol, about the possibility of Luca being taken from her, and less about random men with guns enforcing their own decrees. She avoids ranking the possibilities in terms of their potential for violence. Whatever their uniforms, their accents, their faces, no importa. She knows that anyone they encounter here, in this wild, desolate place, would mean the end. What are we going to do? Marisol asks. El Chacal is already removing his pack. We'll wait here, he says. This is the only cover. Anyway, the trucks look more like vigilantes than carteleros. How can you tell? Choncho asks. The coyote hands Choncho the binoculars without removing them from his neck. The big man peers into them. They're not fancy enough to be narcos, El Chacal says. And if they're vigilantes, as I suspect, they've probably gone migrant hunting up the trail on the far side. We wait here. They'll eventually go back to the trucks, and we can pass after they leave. But what if they are narcos? Marisol asks. Lydia shudders involuntarily, rubs her hands over her face, and shrugs her hood up. Won't we be sitting ducks right between them and whatever shipment they're waiting for? Mira, I've already paid the toll to pass through here, El Chacal says. I play by their rules. But whose rules? Lydia can no longer keep the question to herself. She has to know which cartel is the self-appointed owner of this scrap of desert. Los jardineros? Lorenzo asks. The coyote doesn't answer, and in the silence that follows, Lorenzo catches Lydia's eye. Lorenzo paces like a caged animal. This terrible hypothetical finally presses itself into Lydia's consciousness. Would it be worse to get caught by estadounidenses, who would take Luca from her, or to get caught by Mexicanos, who would return them to Javier? With effort, she represses the speculation. Neither thing can happen. They must succeed. She claps her fists against her thighs and stretches her cramping legs. Choncho hands the binoculars back to El Chacal and begins removing his pack. Slim and their sons do the same, setting their water jugs wordlessly on the ground and reclining against their backpacks. El Chacal takes a measured sip of water from his own jug. Find a place to tuck yourself in case the sun comes up before we're able to move. The coverage isn't great here in this stand of scrappy trees. But there is a thicket nearby, and Rebecca, Soledad, and Lydia all set themselves up facing the rear, watching the path they've already taken halfway down the hill, waiting for the shapes of their nightmares to emerge from the dark. Luca sits back to back with Mami and has time to consider how strange it is that being a migrante means you spend more time stopping than in motion. Their lives have become an erratic wheel of kinesis and paralysis. Beto falls asleep. Nicolás falls asleep. Marisol would like to fall asleep. They've all grown fatigued. Light grows in the eastern sky, and by the time the dozen men approach the four trucks on the road below, picking their way down the trail on the opposite hill, it's bright enough for El Chacal to see them clearly with the assistance of his binoculars. Vigilantes, he confirms. The men, dressed entirely in camouflage and bearing enough visible weaponry that anyone not knowing better would presume them to be authorized military, take their time at the trucks. They open coolers, remove drinks and food. They gather at the back of one of the trucks and pass a thermos of coffee. They're close enough now that when the wind shifts in certain directions, the migrants can hear a whip of laughter here, a scrap of sentence there. Those shifting acoustics are terrifying, because those sounds must also travel in reverse. The migrants all become aware of their anatomy. No one wants to sneeze or fart. They pray for the men to go away. Breakfast takes forever, and then, just when it seems they are packed up and ready to go, they discover the interior cab light that was left on in one of the trucks. The battery is dead. By the time the men locate some jumper cables, maneuver the trucks into position, hook everything up, get the truck running, spend 5 to 10 minutes congratulating one another on getting the truck running, and finally, at long last, parade themselves down the road and out of sight, it is full daylight in the desert. The migrants are still almost a mile from the hidden place where El Chacal intends to make camp for the day, and now they must contend with the danger of the glaring daylight. He shakes Nicolás and Beto to wake up. "Let's go," he says. "Double time." Lucas' limbs feel stiff after the time spent shivering on the cold ground. He's happy to get them going again, and happy when the warmth begins to seep back into his legs. The road below is nothing like the roads Luca imagined he'd encounter in the USA. He thought every road here would be broad as a boulevard, paved to perfection and lined with fluorescent shop fronts. This road is like the crappiest Mexican road he's ever seen. Dirt, dirt, and more dirt. To the northwest, there's a huddle of hills taller than the ones they've encountered so far. And after they cross the road, El Chacal begins to ascend the slope of the closest one. It's steep, and everyone focuses their energy on moving their bodies efficiently uphill. "Why don't we go around?" Lorenzo complains. "Because we take my route," El Chacal tells him. "But that way looks way easier," Lorenzo points north. "Vete entonces." El Chacal dislikes Lorenzo. There's a tension between these two men. Luca understands because there's a tension between Lorenzo and every person he encounters. Most people, because of decorum, attempt to disguise that conflict, but the coyote doesn't bother, and Luca likes that. Instead, when Lorenzo speaks, El Chacal makes a face that's like the opposite of rolling his eyes, where his features get really still, and he looks away from Lorenzo with his eyelids half closed, and he just waits for the words to go away. After a moment, he reanimates himself and presses on. When they reach the apex of the hill and behold the vista on the other side, an uncomfortable feeling of both thrill and dread shivers right through Luca's whole body. It's so severe that Mami actually sees the quake of his limbs from her peripheral vision and turns her head to look at him. He makes sure not to catch her eye. He's enraptured, anyway, by the panorama that caused the feeling in him. They all are. On the far side of this hill are 100 more just like it, and probably 100 more beyond those that they can't see, because the hills get taller and sharper and more formidable as they go. The sunlight cracks across them in crazy stabs of brightness. The hills are covered in golden, wind-beaten grasses, spiky plants, and scrubby trees. There are huge boulders everywhere, studded into the creases of the hills, perched on rickety ledges, gathered in hollows like intransigent families. A few of the rocks are so gargantuan, they dwarf the hills beneath them. The sky is merciless above, wheeling clouds to shift the light, playing tricks, making it impossible to gauge distances, but never covering the hot, ruthless globe of the sun. Luca pauses there to snatch the hat from his head and stuff it into his coat pocket. He's suddenly covered with sweat. He peels the scarf and jacket off and unzips his backpack to stuff them in. He retrieves Papi's red hat and takes a whiff of the hatband before fixing it back onto his head and reslinging the backpack onto his shoulders. But the coyote looks over and shakes his head.
You can't wear the hat, he says. You can spot the red from a mile away.
Luca frowns at Mommy, but she nods, and Luca unhappily removes Papi's hat. He hands it to Mommy, and she tries to sip it back into his pack.
You can wear mine, Lydia removes her hat and holds it out to him.
But it's pink, he protests.
Hardly.
I'll take it, Beto says.
Lydia laughs.
I wish I had an extra one for you, she says.
She plops it on Luca's head and returns to the zipper on Luca's pack, trying to get Papi's hat back in. The backpack is stuffed. She pauses to pull a white t-shirt out from inside. Here, she says, handing the shirt to Beto. Use this. He fixes the neck of the t-shirt over his head and lets the fabric drape down his neck to shield his skin from the sun. He grins at Lydia.
Thanks.
Everyone has paused here, suddenly aware of the mounting heat. They're all peeling off layers and regrouping. Slim and Choncho are sharing water from one of their jugs. There's a reason this landscape is devoid of people. Why it's still feasible to cross here without getting caught. It seems impossible that any creature could survive in such a place.
It doesn't even look real, Mommy says.
Beside Luca, Lorenzo removes his own cap and wipes his brow. That hat was pristine the first time Luca saw it, at the migrant shelter in Huehuetoca. Now the brim is still flat, but the sun has sapped its color from black to gray. That change is startling to Luca. He's unaccustomed to the potency of the Sonoran sun, how quickly it corrodes whatever's beneath its gaze. He pulls Mommy's hat off his head to examine it more closely, and he realizes that the pink really isn't pink anymore. It's only the bleached memory of pink, a dirty sand color. That's what Mommy meant when she said, hardly. Lorenzo leans his hands on his knees and looks out across the hopeless vista.
I know manches, cabrón, he says. You gotta be kidding me.
I guess this is what he meant by grueling, Beto wheezes, pulling the empty inhaler from his pocket to suck on it.
You okay?
Luca asks, gesturing at the inhaler. Beto shrugs and tries to regulate his breath, his eyes squinting against the brightness of the sun.
Why, you got some albuterol in there?
He pokes at Luca's backpack.
Because I'll take it if you do.
Both boys laugh, and Beto's sounds like a dying balloon.
Venga, mijo, Mami says, prompting Luca to walk in front of her.
You too, Beto. You okay to walk?
He doesn't waste any more breath on words, but nods and gets moving. Each hill looks like it would take a half a day to walk up and a half a day to walk back down. The migrants file downhill in El Chacal's wake. They're silent now, descending into the first seam of the valley, struggling to keep their minds strong as they face the enormity of their undertaking. The wind rockets across the landscape and whips Rebecca's hair into a black tornado. Their feet crunch through the witchy yellow grass, and Lucas's body is flooded with awful excitement. They're in the United States now, and already it looks like a movie set, but with real desert animals that can kill you, like scorpions and rattlesnakes and mountain lions. Luca experiences a swamp of tingly, nauseating confusion.
Luca,
Mommy's right behind him. Sometimes it's like she can hear what he's thinking.
You doing okay?
He nods.
I'm proud of you, mijo,
she whispers so no one else can hear. She makes a muscle.
Eres bien fuerte. Papi would be proud.
El Chacal knows where there's a water station,
a place where aid workers leave water for passing migrants. He's made them conserve their supplies anyway, because sometimes the water's not there. Sometimes the border patrol or vigilantes find it first and destroy it. But today, it's there, marked by a whipping blue flag atop a pole, three huge jugs sitting on a pallet beneath a tarp. It's not cold, but it's the best water Lydia has ever tasted. Her head was beginning to pound because she was conserving their supply. But now she drinks her fill from her canteen and feels the pain diminish at once. It feels like a miracle to drink. She refills her canteen again and drinks some more. Luca drinks very little.
As much as you can, amorcito, she insists.
But I'll get a cramp. We have to walk so fast.
Cramps you can live with, she says. Drink.
They rest beside the water station for 10 minutes, filling their jugs and drinking, and filling them again before they strike out deeper across the valley floor. El Chacal has warned them to stay quiet, to listen all the time for the sound of engines, but the wind is too loud for that.
Beto starts chatting to Choncho.
Where you guys from? Beto asks.
Choncho is slow to respond, not from reluctance, but just because that's his way.
Veracruz, he says eventually.
That in Mexico?
Another pause.
Yes.
I didn't know they made Mexicans as big as you.
Choncho laughs, and it sends a ripple through the whole group. Beto looks from Choncho to his brother Slim to their two sons.
Everybody in Veracruz as tall as you?
No, Choncho says slowly. Much taller.
Beto is listing all the tallest people he can think of from El Dompe when El Chacal makes the low-pitched warning whistle. Marisol spots the problem at the same time and inadvertently cries out. She points across the valley to a ridge on the far side where a trail of fawn, powdery dust, rises up through the foliage. El Chacal does his whistle once more, commanding everyone to drop, and it's instant the way they obey. They drop like they were shot, all 15 of them, right where they stand.
Get into the shade if you can, he says.
The light is vigorous here. To be in it is to be discovered. To be out of it is to be concealed. When the desert sunlight shines on any scrap of moving color, that color radiates like a beacon. Mami and Luca huddle together beneath the shade of a rock, pressed up beside a silk tassel tree. Catkins hang down from its branches in pale green curtains that drop their clinging flowers into Mami's hair. Tucked into this dark alcove and curled behind their backpacks, they're invisible from the ridge, where that plume of dust is growing steadily across the hillside in a sputtering line. Around them, the other migrants squirm to find cover, flattening themselves into the parched grasses, twisting themselves into the spiky shadows of yucca fronds, folding themselves into the silhouette of a cypress tree. They all become perfectly motionless and silent. Even Beto is quiet, lying flat among the blonde stalks, his toes pointing up to the sky. When 3 minutes have passed, they finally hear the vague rumble of an engine slurring itself into the wind. After another full minute, the vehicle appears on a slope not far above them, on the next hill over. It's the distinct white and green Chevy Tahoe of the U.S. Border Patrol. El Chacal's face betrays nothing.
Nobody move, he says quietly.
He's well hidden between Marisol and Nicolás in the shade of a standing rock. Because he knows it might be some time before they can move again, he always makes sure to land in a comfortable position. He sits on his bottom with his knees up, and trains his binoculars on the passenger seat of the Chevy Tahoe, where a Border Patrol agent trains his own military-grade binoculars back toward them.
We are invisible,
Luca says to himself, and he closes his eyes.
We are desert plants. We are rocks.
He breathes deeply and slowly, taking care that his chest doesn't rise and fall with the cycle of his breath. The stillness is a kind of meditation all migrants must master.
We are rocks. We are rocks. Somos piedras.
Lucas's skin hardens into a stony shell. His arms become immovable, his legs permanently fixed in position. The cells of his backside and the bottoms of his feet amalgamate with the ground beneath him. He grows into the earth. No part of his body itches or twitches, because his body is not a body anymore, but a slab of native stone. He's been stationary in this place for millennia. This silk tassel tree has grown up from his spine. The indigenous plants have flourished and died here around his ankles. The fox sparrows and meadow larks have nested in his hair. The rains and winds and sun have beaten down across the rigid expanse of his shoulders. And Luca has never moved. We are rocks. At length, the Tahoe finishes its noisy and discreet voyage across the ridge and disappears over a low rim into the next seam of the valley beyond. El Chacal doesn't waste time on chit-chat. The sun is lodging itself ever higher into the hot, bright shelf of the sky, and they should have made camp an hour ago. It's not safe for them to be exerting themselves beneath the burning lamp of the sun. It will sap them.
Vámonos, he says. Apúrense!
Just as quickly as they dropped, everyone rises, collects their belongings, and once again, they're on the move. By late morning, just as that sun is sucking all the moisture from their depleted bodies, just as Rebecca feels ready to give up, behind the skirting of a deep hill, they come to a shaded fold of land where a cluster of trees hides a good camp. Sumac and mountain mahogany band together beneath the jagged ridges, so their camp is entirely concealed from view. They are deeply in shade, and it's a blessed relief to be out from under the sun. There are signs all around the clearing of previous campers, discarded plastic water bottles, a ripped black t-shirt covered with salt stains, a worn pink sneaker, much smaller than Luca's. El Chacal goes directly to a soft clump of sand beneath a tree where all the rocks have been cleared. He pitches his pack down beside the trunk and immediately settles himself into sleep. The others follow suit. It's easy for the men, who seem to sleep wherever they drop. Marisol lies flat on her stomach and rests her head on her outstretched arms. She, too, is asleep instantly. The sisters are restless, and they move several times before they find comfort. Despite her exhaustion, Lydia expects to have trouble sleeping. She flings out their blanket anyway, and she and Luca collapse onto it. The desert sun is so bright that even here in the deep shade, Lydia finds herself squinting to block out the light. When she opens her eyes to look around, the landscape beyond this seam of shade is one wide expanse of sepia, everything bleached into varying fractures of brown by the adamant sun. Choncho notices her wakefulness and gives her a somber nod, which Lydia interprets as a promise to watch over her and her sleeping child. You rest. I will make sure nothing happens to you, is the meaning she chooses to attach to that ambiguous nod. And with that imagined vow of protection, at once, she drops into sleep.
Chapter 32. They don't wait until dark to set out. As soon as the sun dips near the ridge at the western end of the valley, and their shadows lengthen to undulating streaks of black along the desert floor, El Chacal tells them to make themselves ready.
Tonight is difícil, the coyote tells him. 8 miles, rough terrain. You have to keep up. If you fall behind, we cannot wait for you.
I won't risk the whole group for one individual. So listen up. Esto es importante. It's life or death. El chacal clears his throat to make sure everyone's listening. Just west of here, the road we crossed early this morning cuts north and runs sort of parallel to the route we're taking. Okay? They all nod. If you get separated from the group, if you fall, if you twist an ankle, if you decide you need a rest or a piss or a scratch or a sleep, if for any reason you cannot keep up, you go to that road. That is the Ruby Road. Border Patrol and locals pass there regularly. You won't die out here if you get to that road. In a few hours, someone will find you there. It's a grim business, the Ruby Road, and none of them can picture it yet, not while things are going well. Right now, that road is to be avoided at all costs. It's the very nexus of their fear. It's impossible for the migrants to imagine the desperation that might, only a few hours hence, convince them to seek deliverance there. We travel this way, El Chacal gestures with a slice of his hand. North. So which way is the road? I want you all to know it. Lorenzo, which way is the road? Lorenzo doesn't answer. It's west, El Chacal repeats with exasperation. Which way is west? Lorenzo reaches for his phone, but there's no signal in the desert. It's that way, Luca points west. Claro que sí. The coyote ruffles Luca's hair. This kid's not gonna die in the desert. They eat nuts and strips of beef jerky while they walk. The PhD student, Nicolas, has some kind of protein paste in single-serving tinfoil tubes. They look and smell disgusting, but they're packed with nutrients, and indeed, his energy is impressive. He's directly behind Lydia this evening, and he makes quiet conversation as they walk. She wonders if the protein tubes are caffeinated. Whatever you do, don't go to Arivaca, he's saying. If you're dying of thirst, those people will pull up a lawn chair and sip lemonade while they watch. Ah, they're not that bad, El Chacal interrupts from ahead. There are good people in Arivaca, too. Life is complicated for them, living so close to the line. Nicolás raises his remarkable eyebrows. Although Arivaca is a tiny, remote town of fewer than 700 people, a 45-minute drive down empty roads from its nearest neighbor, Nicolás, like most people who live in southern Arizona, knows its reputation as a merciless, hard-scrabble outpost, a place where vigilante militiamen murdered a 9-year-old girl and her father years ago, hoping to pin the blame on illegal migrants. The vigilantes wanted to stoke community fear and incite outrage by inventing a group of murderous migrant boogeymen, so they broke into the Flores family home and shot little Briseña in the head. She was wearing turquoise pajama bottoms and red-painted fingernails when she died, curled up on the love seat in her living room. But because Nicolás is a young politicized liberal who's never been to Arivaca, he hasn't observed how the shame of that murder still weighs on the tiny town. He's never been close to a tragedy that barbaric, never experienced a shock so primitive that it shakes him to the very core of his beliefs. In short, Nicolás has never had a fundamental change of heart. So he's unaware of the way Newton's third law can resonate in a place like this. For every wickedness, there is an equal and opposite possibility of redemption. In any case, the point is moot. Lydia has no intention of going to Arivaca, a place where the only way out is to turn yourself in to ask for help. She and Luca are going to make it to Tucson, to safety. They hike almost 3 miles without incident, and it's amazing to watch the colors leach back into the desert after the day's blanching. There's a moment, Lydia realizes, Or no, more than a moment, a span of perhaps 15 minutes just at twilight, when the desert is the most perfect place that exists. The temperature, the light, the colors, all hang and linger at some unflawed precipice, like the cars of a roller coaster ticking ever so slowly over the apex before the crash. The light droops ever farther from the sky, and Lydia can smell the heat of the day wicking away from her skin. Lucas's backpack bobs in front of her, for the first time since she stood up from the chair on her mother's back patio in Acapulco and left her iced paloma sweating on the table, Lydia feels like they might survive. A weird lurch of something like exhilaration. And then quite suddenly, it's very dark and very cold. Colder than the night before, if she's not imagining it. And that chill has the effect of prompting all 15 of them to move faster. The ground is jagged, studded with rocks, pitching and rising unpredictably, pockmarked by the hidey holes of unseen animals. Lydia prays that no one falls. The sisters have been uncommonly quiet, she notices, and she worries about their stamina, so soon after their bodies have endured those other traumas. Lydia prays too, for Lucas's feet in his new boots, and for Soledad's and Rebecca's feet, for her own feet. Dear God, keep them strong and unblistered. Let them step only in places where human feet are supposed to go. El Chacal moves at a brutal pace. The rendezvous point is just over a dozen miles north of the border as the crow flies, but those miles cover some of the roughest terrain in North America, with elevation changes of up to 7,000 feet. Their 2.5-day path winds around the worst of the impassable sections and funnels them toward cattle tanks in case they get desperate for water, all while keeping them as far away from popular hiking trails and known migra patrolling routes as possible. At the end of tonight's walk, near dawn, when they make camp in a cave-like formation a few miles west of Tumacacori, Carmen, Arizona, they'll be almost home free. The migrants don't know this yet. They don't know any of the details, really, because El Chacal likes to keep things relatively covert. If anything goes wrong, if a migrant wanders off or lags behind and gets picked up, the coyote doesn't want the migrant confessing the whole thing to Border Patrol. All they need to know is to follow El Chacal, to do what he tells them to do. If they listen, if they obey, if they persevere, he'll see to it that they survive this journey. Tomorrow night, they'll be pleasantly surprised by the shortness of their walk. There will be more delighted sounds of wonder among them as they approach the campsite where two RVs are waiting to drive them up the crude, unpaved road that eventually ushers them onto the kind of smooth northern highway they've all envisioned. The flat, wide pavement of Route 19 awaits. The Border Patrol checkpoint there is closed for a specific number of hours each week. The coyote, with the exchange of regular money for reliable information, knows which hours those are. It's a 45-minute drive from there to Tucson, to the optimistic anonymity of urban Arizona. It's so close. The migrants don't even realize how close. But now, in the fifth hour of their vigorous hike, as the loose gravel of the black slope they're descending in some unnamed canyon slips treacherously underfoot, just as their spirits are beginning to mirror the fatigue of their bodies, there's an almighty crack in the sky, followed by a downpour. They're shocked. All of them, and even Nicolás and El Chacal, who are both well-prepared with rain gear, are soaked before they manage to get their ponchos on. Their bodies want them to seek shelter, and it takes some measure of minutes for them to quell those instincts and return to their pace, trudging through those curtains of rain. Lucas' jeans are heavy with rainwater, and he has to walk with his legs spread apart because the wet denim chafes between his thighs and against one spot at the back of his left hip. He's glad for the new hiking boots, and glad that Mami insisted he wear them all around the apartment for the 2 days in Nogales to break them in. He's glad he hadn't complained or argued, even though he'd wanted to. But even with that extra practice, with each step, he's increasingly aware of a pinpoint, a tiny dot, only the width of a thread, on the back of his left heel that's beginning to trouble him. At first, he ignores it. Then he addresses it. He tells it that no puny, insignificant speck of pain will prevent him from reaching his destination. He tells it that he would endure 100 such pains, 1,000, without blinking an eye. He is Luca. His whole family has been murdered. He is unstoppable.
Mami? His voice is soft, with pain, curdled. What is it, mijo?
I have a blister, he confesses. It's excruciating. He cannot go on.
Mami presses her lips together and draws him to the side of the trail out of the line. The other migrants don't stop or even slow. They continue at speed, and by the time Lydia's down on one knee with Lucas's pant leg rolled up at the cuff and his sock pulled down, they've all passed. It's difficult to see in the dark and the rain, but El Chacal has forbidden the use of flashlights. So Lydia draws her face down close to Lucas's heel to investigate. His socks are sopping, and she runs her hand across the back of his foot, where she can feel the forming bubble of a blister. There's nothing she can do for him because of the dampness of his skin, the dampness of his jeans, the dampness of everything. Band-aids are impossible, but she has to try. She unslings her pack, finds the zippered compartment on one side where she stashed a handful of band-aids before they set out. They are wet, of course, but Lydia selects the driest one from the middle of the stack. She opens her coat and leans over his ankle, trying to make an umbrella of her body.
Take the boot off, she says.
But Mommy, they're going, he says. We don't have time.
Do it quickly, she snaps.
Luca obeys, tugging on the laces, ripping off the boot, which somersaults to the ground beneath.
Sit here.
She points to her pack and Luca sits. Sock too, she says, and then she glances up through the streamers of rain to where she thinks she can still see the last of the group disappearing into the darkness. She stashes the wrapped band-aid between her lips. Luca whips off the wet sock and she crams it into her pocket, untucks her shirt from beneath her hoodie, and uses her shirt tail to dry his foot as best she can. His little toes are pruned. She tucks his foot into the warm fold of her armpit and then reaches over Luca's shoulder to unzip the backpack he's still wearing. She knows there are two pairs of socks inside, right-hand side, near the bottom. She worries that her panic will make her clumsy, that she won't be able to find the socks, groping blindly into the pack this way, that she'll find them and drop them, and they'll be drenched and useless, and they will have lost the group for nothing, that they will die here, not shot through with cartel bullets at a family party, but alone in the desert. They will both die because of a blister, because of rain. No. There, her fingers brush against a soft ball of rolled socks, still dry.
Gracias a Dios.
She tugs them out and sticks them into her armpit with a foot, sips the pack. The other migrants are gone now. She can no longer see them or hear them, but all her senses strain after them. She sends her mind to follow the direction they were taking.
God, please let us find them, she prays.
She peels the wrapper off the band-aid, spits the papers onto the ground, gives Luca's foot another wipe with her shirt tail, blows on the damp foot with her meager breath, and then presses the adhesive bandage against the curve of his skin.
Please, God, let it stick.
She unfolds the dry socks and tugs one onto his foot. It seems to take hours, the wriggling of the foot into the tube of material, the correct placement of the seam across the toe, the adjustment of the dry cotton into position around the afflicted heel. She thinks about putting the second one on him, too, an extra layer of protection between the boot and the skin. Would that be better or worse for the blister? Extra padding, but a tighter fit. The time constraint is the deciding factor. She tucks the other dry sock beneath her bra strap and retrieves the toppled boot. She loosens the laces and pulls at the tongue. She wipes the inside of the boot with her shirt tail, and Luca jams his foot in. She yanks on the laces. "I'll do it, Mommy," he says. She holds her coat over him while he ties the boot quickly, impressively, and then, "I'm good," he says. "I'm okay, Mommy. Thank you." And he stands up from her backpack. He takes a few steps to test the repair. "Much better," he says. Lydia has refastened the side zipper on her pack and is already walking after him, jogging, really, while she slings the backpack around to her shoulders. The gallon jugs of water bang and slosh beneath. "Go, mijo, quickly. We have to catch up," she says. Altogether, the delay costs them perhaps 2.5 minutes, maybe 3. Enough time to become completely lost from the group. They're well out of earshot because all they can hear is the thundering wash of the rain hammering down all around them. Lydia feels panicky, all her fears compressed into a tight ball that lodges in her chest. "This is how it happens," she thinks. And her voice becomes frantic as she urges Luca to move faster. But he's remembering, too, that day outside Culiacán, when La Migra were chasing them and Mami twisted her ankle and fell. They can't afford a twisted ankle on top of everything else, Luca thinks. And that worry slows him into a pace that's too cautious. So perhaps this will be it instead. They will die from caution.
"Apúrate, mijo, please!"
Lydia fights against a mounting scream in her throat. And now there's a new doubt. What if they're hurrying in the wrong direction, diverging only slightly from the path, a fork, so that with each step they stray a little farther from the group? "This is the way they went, isn't it?" There's no possibility of tracking them in this rain, in this dark. They have to just go. "Move. Keep moving." In desperation, Lydia breaks the crucial rule about silence, and she calls out for them. But there's no response. They walk and stumble and hurry through the dark for some time. And every few minutes, she breaks that rule again, louder and more desperately each time Lydia tries a name.
"Soledad? Rebecca? Beto? Help! Nicolás? Choncho? Where are you?"
Luca is no longer in front of her or behind her, but beside her, holding her hand, and she glances infrequently at the darkness of his eyes, and she sees that he's calm. He doesn't share her panic.
"It's okay, Mommy," he says at length. "This is the right way."
She believes him because she must, and he knows these things, doesn't he?
"Chacal, Marisol, Slim, hello?"
The only answer is the whip of falling rain in thick cords upon their shoulders, fat drops spattering against their hoods. She pushes through the darkness, and in some detached corner of her mind, where operations are still functioning normally, she makes jokes for herself about being lost in the desert for 40 days, for 40 millennia. Her Catholic vision of hell is all wrong. There's no fire, no wretched burning. Hell is wet and cold and black and lost. Her brain tap dances and contracts, and then, she sees a shape moving through the darkness, a shadow, a barely discernible movement, a distant blotch of black that's a slightly dimmer shade of black than all the fixed blacks around it. Lydia yelps and feels a shot of hope club through her sternum, and she squeezes Luca's hand and drags him into a quicker pace, and she charges after that blotch of black as it moves through the invisible landscape. and she's not imagining it. It's no mirage. It continues its trajectory. Bump, bump. It moves forward, and Lydia fixes her eyes on it, and she follows. She pulls Luca. She runs, heedless of the treacherous ground beneath their feet, until the shape grows larger, closer. And it is a backpack. It is Ricardine's backpack. She calls out once more, "Ricardine, David." And the shape pauses, turns toward her. They are found. They are saved. "Salvación, salvación," Lydia cries. Ricardine ushers her into the line ahead of him, ahead of his primo David. And here are the sisters, Rebecca, Soledad. It's easy for Lydia to believe the girls might not have noticed their absence. It's so dark and the rain is falling so hard. It's difficult to observe anything beyond the border of your own hood, your outstretched hands, your churning feet. Lydia doesn't want to know if the sisters noticed they were gone, if they mentioned it to El Chacal, or asked him to stop and wait. If she doesn't know, then she doesn't have to ask herself what she might have done in their position. It's okay now, anyway. It doesn't matter. It's okay. Lydia crosses herself in the darkness. She breathes into her shoulders. She inhales the endless rain. Chapter 33. The downpour stops, just as abruptly as it started. And in its wake, Luca hears a new chorus of uncomfortable music in their midst. Their shoes squelch beneath them. The drenched denim of their jeans murmurs stiffly when their legs move against each other. Luca's teeth chatter, and he becomes so cold he can almost hear his brain shivering in his skull. He begins to wonder if being freezing and wet in the aftermath of rain might be worse than the rain itself. The same way your body, once adapted to the cold Pacific water of Acapulco Bay, can yearn for the mantle of that water after you emerge onto the hot, dry sand of Playa Condesa. Your body can get mixed up about what's hot and what's cold, Luca thinks. But then it begins to rain again, and Luca knows that his hypothesis was una mierda. The night passes in misery, in bouts of torrential rain and intermittent periods of respite. Lydia tries to maintain her sense of relief, her feeling that they are saved. But their backpacks and jeans chafe their skin raw, and then it rains again. Every one of them, once or twice at least, every one of them despairs. The only thought that sustains them is the notion that each moment they endure this misery is one less moment they have yet to endure. "There's a blessing of the rain," El Chacal says as they lace their way through the seam of a canyon. "Everybody hates it." Luca and Lydia have returned to their place near the front of the line, behind Choncho and Slim and Beto. Rebecca and Soledad are directly behind them now, followed by Marisol, Nicolás, Lorenzo, David, and Ricardine. And then the two quiet men who carry their names in secret. The boulders in this seam of land are broad and smooth underfoot, slick with water, and Luca notices that he can begin to make out their shapes in the dark. They come to a place where the boulders form a kind of natural staircase the migrants descend. And then the walls of the canyon rise up on either side of them, and they walk along the bottom of a gulch, where a stream of rainwater sloshes around their ankles. They follow El Chacal tight along the left-hand side of the gully, where the path is driest, and irregular ledges jut from the canyon walls. It's just the kind of landscape that daredevil Pilar from school would like to climb if she were here, Luca thinks. He could climb it too. He knows now. He can do things Pilar never dreamed of. The first traces of dark gray daylight brush the walls of the gorge by degrees while the coyote talks. When it rains, the narcos stay in their SUVs. La migra agents stay in their dens. We sneak past while they take shelter.
Only migrants venture out in the rain, Choncho says.
Only lunatics, Slim corrects him. But the rain is fickle in the desert, and as the lid of night slowly lifts, Luca watches the oppressive clouds rolling like the wheels of La Bestia across the still dark sky. Those clouds gather and crush and demolish, and after they pass, they leave a blank void of gray nothing behind them. Soon the sun will come and fill that void with hot color. Soon La Migra will return. They walk in haste.
How much farther?
Beto asks, because no one has spoken in a long time. And even more than that, he wants an answer. He wants to hear the reassuring sound of another human voice.
An hour? Maybe less, the coyote answers.
Most people who meet El Chacal at this stage of his life presume he got his moniker because of his work as a coyote. But in fact, his family has called him that since he was 12 years old. When he was a boy in Tamaulipas, Juan Pedro, as he was known back then, found a pup one day on the side of the road. The pup's mother had been struck by a car and killed. The other litter maids had scattered or been picked off by the time Juan Pedro arrived and found the lone pup sitting bereft beside the cold body of its mother. Juan Pedro took the pup home, and as it grew, despite the meticulous care and affection Juan Pedro gave it, it became a wild, rangy-looking thing. People in the village took to calling the pup the jackal, which was fine by Juan Pedro, who liked the wildness of it. But then they began calling Juan Pedro Mother of Jackal, which he didn't like quite so much. He endured that name for some time and was glad when eventually folks stopped mentioning the dog entirely and shortened his nickname to El Chacal. Despite the name, El Chacal had no intention of becoming a coyote. Few people do. He crossed once many years ago, when he was still a young man looking for work. And he intended to make just the one crossing. It was much easier back then, but still no picnic, not in Arizona. The other migrants he was with during that first crossing found it strenuous and difficult. But El Chacal discovered that he liked these high desert places. He found that they suited him. They opened his lungs and the good heat of his body. He spent a few months working as a dishwasher at a diner in Phoenix. And whenever he had time off, he liked to go hiking through the canyons. It wasn't long before he went home to Tamaulipas. The next time he crossed, he did it alone, without a guide. It was crazy, but he did it without difficulty. He did it with a map and a compass. And what's more, he enjoyed it the way some people enjoy boot camp or a marathon. He liked the strain it put on his muscles and his mind. He liked the undercurrent of survivalist danger. So then he did it again. Several more times without company, and each time he crossed, he grew stronger and smarter. He adjusted his route, perfected his bearings. Then he brought a group of friends from Tamaulipas with him. They were so impressed by his knowledge of the land, by the apparent ease with which he navigated the difficult terrain, that they hired him to bring their girlfriends, their children, their cousins, their parents. Quite accidentally, El Chacal found himself with a thriving business in human smuggling. It was exciting for him to be good at something after a lifetime of mediocrity in Tamaulipas. His reputation grew, and as the border tightened and his previous routes became impassable, as he had to strike farther and farther into the desert, into more arduous, perilous tracks all the time, El Chacal realized he could charge a lot of money for this service. Then the cartels moved in. So he doesn't make as much money now, and what's more, he doesn't enjoy the work as he once did. He used to feel like a minor hero, a guide with the power to lead people to the promised land. Now he pays La Migra and the cartels both for the privilege of crossing this binational scrap of dirt. They eat his profits and his freedom. When they demand favors of him, he cannot say no. Sometimes they ask him to carry something he doesn't want to carry. Once in a while, they tell him to take someone he doesn't want to take. Soon, El Chacal will retire. He has enough money saved. And now that he's almost 39 years old, the travails of this repetitive journey are beginning to outweigh his boyish sense of adventure. He'll go home to Tamaulipas. Maybe he'll marry Pamela, whom he's loved since he was a boy. Maybe she'll finally say yes. Why not? Meanwhile, he tries to be stern with the migrants. He tries to be detached because attachments can be fatal. He needs to be at liberty to make decisions for the good of the group. And if he grows too fond of one of his pollitos, that makes it harder to make a tough decision in a pinch, to leave someone behind if he sees they're not going to make it. But recently, it's difficult for him to discern how much of his callousness is still an act. He wears a rosary around his neck to countermand his worries about the flagging condition of his soul. The tattoo on his right forearm reads, "Jesús anda conmigo." And mostly, he still believes it. He wants it to be true. When they hear the cry behind them, the migrants instinctively duck, but El Chacal, still on his feet, turns toward the sound. Across the tops of the migrants' heads, he sees, approaching from behind and moving as swiftly as a nightmare through the charcoal colors of the canyon, a fast-flowing black mass of water. It's descending the staircase behind him. "Get up!" he shouts. "Arriba!" His voice bangs and echoes against the walls of the canyon, all his furtive inclinations suspended. He shouts at them, "Get up! Up!" He leaps from rock to rock ahead and then reaches for a broad ledge just higher than his waist and hoists himself aloft. The migrants follow, and El Chacal reaches back to help them up, first Luca and Beto, then the sisters and Lydia, and now Lorenzo is already up. "Help them!" El Chacal shouts at him, so Lorenzo leans down, gives Marisol his hand, and pulls her up. And in this way, one by one, the migrants scramble up and away from the advancing wall of water, and those at the front try to move up again to make room for the others to follow. And here's another ledge, just higher, so they climb up and up, ascending the wall, and they're almost all up out of the bottom of the gorge now, and it looks so obvious from here, with the water coming so quickly, with the discovery of the alternate path, this higher path, made up entirely of these jutting ledges, that it's an ancient riverbed beneath them. Jesucristo! Even though they'd been near the front of the line, Choncho and Slim and their sons are still below in the gulch because they stayed to help the others. The migrants on the ledge step back to make room for the stragglers to scramble up. They spread out, hasten to scale the ascendant ledges, to reach higher ground. And now Slim is up on the first ledge below, and he reaches back for his nephew, David, and their thick forearms slap against each other as they grab wrists. And Slim hoists the boy up. And now Choncho is up too, but Ricardin is last, Slim's son. And the water is so fast and so high that it doesn't reach Ricardin's ankles first and then engulfs his legs, but rather it hits the entire back of his body at once and knocks him forward, and he's dragged along in its maw like a rag doll. And they all shout and yelp, and El Chacal and the two brothers run and leap from ledge to ledge after him, or after his backpack, really, because that's all they can see now, his large and floating backpack, the same one that was Lydia's redemption in the darkness. and then Ricardin's arms come flailing out of the water, and he manages to flip himself somehow. And then the backpack is immediately dragged from his body. His arms slip right out, and it's gone. And Ricardin makes one perfunctory effort to reach for the pack, and then realizes immediately that the pack is not the priority. So he returns his attention to his own flagging body, his unusually large frame, whose strength has never failed him before. His papi and tío are on the embankment above him, and the coyote is there, and no one can believe how fast this happened, how the water came out of nowhere, and how fast and strong and deep it is. They're reaching for him and yelling for him, and he can hear his father's voice, but he can't do anything because the water has his arms pinned and his legs are churning and he keeps spitting out mouthfuls of water. But as soon as he spits out one, his mouth is already full again. And it's not only water, but water and soil and sticks and debris. And he's going to drown in it. Ricardin knows he's going to drown. And he has the thought that it would be almost funny to drown in a flash flood in the desert. And then he realizes that he doesn't want his death to be funny, or even almost funny. So he focuses all his energy on his abdominal muscles, on bending himself in half, so the top part of his body comes up out of the water, and once, twice, he reaches for his father's hands and misses. And then, wham! Just like that. He bangs into a rock with his head, and then another right after that. And now he can taste blood, his tooth. His front tooth is sharper than it's always been, and his lip is bleeding. But he's not going to die here. He refuses to die here, in such a stupid, undignified way, when he has a big, strong body to save him. So he looks up at his father on the ledge above, and manages to turn himself just enough so the next rock he hits feet first, and then another, and again, until he's almost bouncing himself along in the water from boulder to boulder. And when the next one comes, he uses it and the momentum of the water to catapult himself up toward the ledge above. And again, he misses his tío's outstretched hand. But the men are yelling encouragement at him and keeping pace with his swift progress by leapfrogging each other. And he knows his plan is a good plan, and if he can do it again, it will work. So again, he twists in the water, except this time, when the next boulder comes and he reaches out his leg, it gets caught there in an underwater crevasse, and the water pushes his body past, but keeps his leg wrenched under, and he can feel the bone snap. And he screams out in pain. But now his father and his tío are there, just above him, and the pain is wicked, but their hands are on him. His papi has his arm, and his tío has the hood of his sweatshirt, and they are hauling him back against the current and toward his wrong-way leg. He feels no relief when the coyote is there too, when they fix their six strong hands on him and together haul the top half of his weight up from the floodwaters and drape it over the lip of the earth above. His body is twisted awkwardly, but he has purchase now. They've got him. He will not drown. The water from his drenched body stains the dirt beneath him a darker color, and his fingers scrabble at the earth. But the lower half of his body is still in the water, stuck. He feels no relief because he knows. My leg is broken. Ricardin does not cry. It's definitely broken. I broke my leg. And it's just as well the other migrants have not followed this far downstream, because no one wants to see or hear the horrific business of removing the boy's leg from where it's caught in the crevice below. The only question is who will stay with him. Slim and Choncho have both done this journey enough times to know how it works and to accept the terrible fate without complaint. They don't plead with El Chacal or the other migrants. They don't beg for help or ask them to stay. Although it would be a reasonable response in these circumstances, they don't drift toward hysteria at the thought of being left alone and immobilized here in the desert. It's Choncho who makes the final decision.
Because I'm the older brother, that's why.
Slim nods.
I'll stay with my godson, Choncho says. We'll give you a head start. And when he's feeling up to it, I'll get him to the Ruby Road.
You take David and go find work for both our families.
The brothers embrace, the hard, back-smacking embrace of working men. Then Slim pulls his son's wet head into his arms.
I'm sorry, papi, Ricardin says.
Slim shakes his head.
Gracias a Dios, you escaped with your life. That's all that matters.
Ricardin and David pray with their fathers before the four of them part ways.
Call Teresa when you get to a phone, when you get picked up, Slim tells his brother.
And I'll call her when we get to Tucson and make sure you're safe.
Choncho nods.
And take this.
Slim sets one of his water jugs down beside his son.
Papi,
take it, Ricky, Slim says.
He squats down on his haunches and looks his son in the eye, and then squeezes his shoulder and stands up with his hat pulled low. He turns his face quickly away.
Behind him, Choncho hugs his son, his hand like a mitt on the back of David's neck. They're both well over 6 feet tall.
Choncho kisses his boy on top of the head and then gives him a light shove toward his uncle.
Stay out of trouble, he says.
Keep the rising sun to your backs, El Chacal tells him. The Ruby Road is barely a mile from here.
A mile, Luca thinks, with a broken leg.
When the coyote herds the migrants back to their route, when they ascend from the canyon into the hot pink dawn, only Luca looks back from the gap at Ricardin and his tío, still sitting on the ledge below. The others keep moving, and Luca can feel their unified will, pushing themselves forward like cogs in machinery, like an escalator. They can't stop the engine or even slow it down. It moves on despite the new rot in their collective spirit. Even the coyote's energy seems to be flagging. But they move on. They move on. The migrants are shuffling past Luca, who hovers now in the gap. Behind them, Choncho pulls his brown baseball cap low over his eyes, and Ricardin's face is a wet twist of pain.
How will they climb out of there when he can't walk? Luca wonders. How will they make it to the road?
Then he banishes that thought and prays instead.
Please let them make it to the road.
Luca, ven, Mami says.
He scrambles to catch up. Chapter 34. The cave, when they finally reach it, is warm and dry, and the rising sun paints the back wall orange and pink and yellow. It's not a sunken cave with a dark hole of a mouth like Luca expected when he heard the word cueva, but rather it's as if a huge divot has been hollowed out of the earth with an ice cream scoop and then softened and cleaned by the elements. There are several copper nails hammered into the top of the cave's opening, and El Chacal takes a sheet from his pack that's painted in earthy stripes the exact colors of the landscape. He tacks the sheet onto the nails above, dropping the migrants into a light shade. The migrants look different in this morning's light than they did in yesterday's. Some of them had already known they were capable of walking away from a wounded man, of abandoning a person in the desert to save themselves. Marisol, for example, believes there's almost no despicable thing she wouldn't do in order to get back to her daughters. Lorenzo would trample a baby to get to El Norte. For others among them, the discovery of their own compliance is an unpleasant surprise. They all know how lucky they are that it was Ricardin who broke his leg, and not them. and the recognition of that good fortune makes them each feel damned, doomed, unconscionable.
Men outside first, the coyote orders them when the sheet is fixed in place.
Lorenzo groans, but the others duck through without complaint.
Rebecca is soaked, and there's a dank smell rising off the back of her neck where the hood of her sweatshirt has gathered the oils running from her sopping hair. Her toes are frozen, and her feet feel raw in her shoes, but she's terrified of taking off her clothes.
It's the only way to get dry, Soledad plops down on her backside and peels off her soggy sneakers. Her toes are tingly.
I feel better already, she says.
They all undress. They don't look at one another. Beto stays in only his underwear because he has nothing else to put on. So Lydia fishes out the same spare t-shirt he wore as a makeshift hat yesterday and hands it to him. The rain has had an unhealthy effect on his lungs, and he rattles and wheezes when he lifts his arms to pull the gifted t-shirt over his head. Lydia finds her own spare clothes rolled inside a plastic bag in her pack to be reasonably dry. Lucas, too. Soledad stands up and removes her sweater, which she holds up in front of Rebecca like a curtain so her sister can change. They all peel the clothes from their wet bodies. They slip into large t-shirts and change their underwear. They'll have to stretch their jeans to dry on the rocks outside. Even though there's a new solemnity among them in the absence of Choncho and Ricardin, the solace of this place, this moment, is extraordinary. The ordeal of the rain makes Lydia appreciate the comfort of dryness in a way she never even considered before now. While the men strip and change in the cave, she and Luca sit just outside the sheet with their bare legs.